Everybody, we'll go ahead and start out with a public hearing on House Bill, how it's going to be organized, 2275. Madam Chair, members, House Bill 2275 requires operators and passengers of privately owned commercial vehicles to use safety belts if the vehicle is designed or used primarily for the transportation of property. The bill is written actually as an exemption to other rules, and so I've provided ORS 811.210 for your easy reference, because that is the main statute, and then this bill flows as these areas do not apply to the safety belt provisions that I provided separately. We have received a no revenue impact, and we're still waiting on the fiscal. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Troy Pistolis, you want to come up?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Troy Costales, manager of the Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. This bill, as Ms. Callens pointed out, is to extend the safety belt law into an area where an individual with a privately owned vehicle that is designed and used for transport of property would be required to use safety belts. Last session, before this body, was a bill that talked about vehicles that were designed and used to move people. An unfortunate incident in the Portland area with figure skater's mom that was killed in a crash in a bus. And so last session, the legislature extended the safety belt law into that area. This would then be dealing with property. In the original groundings of the safety belt law in Oregon, one of the things that was talked about was the people that are going in and out of their vehicles frequently and about allowing that. You have a situation now, you know, roughly 22, 23 years later from when that base foundation was put in there, that a lot of these companies actually have this as part of company policy. You look at it from an insurance point of view, you look at it from a risk management point of view, an employee safety point of view. Many of these companies are required anyway, even though it may not necessarily be put in statute. We do have, if you so choose, some photos of some of the vehicles that we're talking about, but it's generally you're talking about delivery vehicles, things that are transporting property in and around that are not necessarily stopping from house to house to house. There are exemptions still in the safety belt law for those types of instances, medical situations, and others that are still in law, but this is extending the area about moving property. Safety belt law has had a tremendous impact in Oregon, helped reduce our death and injury rate on our roads. This would continue that effort. And safety belts do save lives and make a huge difference if there happens to be a crash, if you are buckled in correctly in your vehicle. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd be more than happy to answer any questions from you or the committee.
Thank you. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Troy, so there are presently exemptions in the law for garbage trucks and folks that newspaper delivery and those kinds of things in the law at present.
Madam Chair and Representative Butler, that's correct.
Follow up.
Yes.
And Troy, in bringing this bill forward, was there a meeting amongst the delivery folks, those folks that transport property in the state, such that those folks came to the table and made expressions that were acknowledged by the Transportation Safety Division and made sure that this was not top-down driven, but actually bottoms up?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, short answer to the question is no. It was not brought forward by coalition of individual companies or drivers. There isn't necessarily a coalition for these entities that are out there, somewhat coming from the side, if you will, versus top-down. This is from officers that are out on the road that are coming into situations where people are not in their belts in these vehicles, yet this is a VW bug that's been painted and has a commercial sign on it that if it didn't have the commercial sign on it, it's a regular passenger vehicle, but that person, because they have it painted and have a sign on it, don't have to wear their belts. And so it's coming from the safety point of view, is saying we have people operating basically passenger vehicles designed with safety devices that aren't using them. So there wasn't a coalition from the industry or a meeting with us with the industry, because there isn't necessarily an industry out there to go to, a representative group.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Bob Russell.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Russell. I'm president of the Oregon Trucking Associations. Safety is absolutely our highest priority. I wanted to let you know that we are in support of House Bill 2275. And perhaps to address Representative Butler's question, I did send out an email to my small package carriers, because my understanding is that's where this particular exemption came from years and years ago. And they all indicated to me that it was their company policy that their drivers wear their seatbelts at all times, and that they had absolutely no objection whatsoever to the change. So I'm here in support.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Bob, you wouldn't be surprised to learn that the brown box carrier that transports brown boxes between my office and the 7 or 8 offices up and down the street, right across the street to the headquarters for the school district and then to the bank and to the law offices, he's not wearing his safety belt. You'd be surprised to know that he's not wearing a safety belt?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I would absolutely be surprised.
So when you're driving 10 or 15 feet to the next stop, there should be buckling their safety belt, and that's what their testimony is to you.
Representative Butler, their testimony to me was it is their company policy that they wear that seat belt every time that vehicle's in motion.
Okay, and just one more follow-up, if I may. Do you understand that there's currently an exemption for paper delivery and mail delivery and garbage collectors?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, I do understand that.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you. Anybody else that didn't get signed up that has an interest in this? Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2275.
Madam Chair, I move 2275 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Gilman has moved House Bill 2275. To the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate it. This is the first that we've received testimony on this. There has been no negative testimony. However, I do have concerns because I watch these folks on a daily basis that are delivering in the various box trucks when they're making deliveries to me and the folks across the street and then back to the next place on the block as they are stopping and then moving 15 feet and stopping. They are not wearing their safety belts. I'm concerned about the fact that we would have, again, another opportunity for selective law enforcement in the state of Oregon. I think that's a wrong message to send, that police will arrest certain people for the violation of the law and not others. So I'm very concerned about this whole approach of top-down driven in this regard, but I also recognize that the folks that represent the biggest of those companies, the folks that are driving over the road for hours and hours and hours, are encouraging the folks to put on their safety belts and to wear them. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments? Seeing none. Those of the opinion House Bill 2275 should be reported to the floor with a due pass recommendation will vote aye, and those opposed, no. And the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Buckley?
Aye.
Representative Butler?
No.
Representative Gilman?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Representative Smith? Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Chair Byer?
Aye. House bill having the motion having received the required majority is declared passed. Thank you. We need a carrier. So
Madam Chair, I would be
proud and happy to carry this bill if you need a carrier from the Transportation Committee.
I would be very happy to have you
carry this bill.
Surprised
you didn't volunteer Representative Greg Smith.
I attempted to do so.
Thank you. Any objection?
I'm disappointed, Representative Buckley. Great opportunity.
Missed the opportunity.
Okay. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2297.
Madam Chair, members, House Bill 2297 establishes a speed limit of 15 miles per hour for narrow roadways in resident districts. Defines narrow roadway to mean a roadway that is located in a residential district. Second of all, is intended for through vehicular traffic, and three, is not of sufficient width to allow one lane of traffic in each direction. We have received a no revenue impact. We're waiting on the fiscal. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Tillman.
Consulting the vice chair of my neighborhood association. For the record, my name is Carolyn Tomei. I'm state representative for House District 41, which is the city limits of Milwaukee and parts of southeast Portland. I've introduced this bill. My written testimony is up there, Judith, to address concerns that have been raised by constituents in my district regarding speeding in residential districts. In my district, we have very many narrow streets where the pavement is not wide enough for two cars to pass. Currently, these residential roads fall within the 25 per mile residential speed limit, and this is just too fast for safety on these very narrow roads. House Bill 2297 formally defines the new term narrow roadway and specifies that the standard speed limit on these narrow roadways be 15 miles per hour. I think there will be discussion on the precise definition of narrow roadway, and representatives are here from the City of Milwaukee and the City of Portland. And actually, we've changed the wording somewhat, and I think that will make it clear. And what we want to emphasize is safety. These roads are too narrow to support a 25-mile-per-hour speed limit. Often there is no curb or paved shoulder, and pedestrians have no safe place to scurry out of the way of passing cars. By slowing traffic on these narrow streets, we protect our children, pedestrians, bicyclists, dog walkers from oncoming traffic. This came up, colleagues, in a neighborhood association meeting, and as I mentioned, the vice chair is here and he will be speaking. We were talking about these narrow roads where, as I said, there are no sidewalks, no curbs, and so people have to walk in the road, and there's a lot of foot traffic up and down, a lot of children in these neighborhoods. And it's scary when we've talked about the cars going through really fast. And as we've said in the Neighborhood Association, well, it's posted 25 miles an hour. And it doesn't make sense. It is just too fast for these. So the vice chair of our Neighborhood Association pointed out that we had a state legislator in our Neighborhood Association and suggested that the state legislator might be able to do something. So I took that on as one of my jobs, and I have done this. And you'll hear from testimony from my Neighborhood Association vice chair and also from the City of Milwaukee and the City of Portland that there are some changes to this, which I think would make it clearer and a better bill. So thank you, and of course I'm open to any questions. And I expect lots of questions from Representative Butler.
Any questions?
just one, so I can clarify this in my own mind. The bill does not provide that they are public roadways, that is, that they're dedicated to the public. I assume that that's what we're talking about.
Exactly,
however, those which are dedicated actually and maintained by the municipalities.
Chair Beyer, Representative Butler, that's exactly what I meant. Thank you for clarifying that.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Jody Weiser. Weiser?
Jody Weiser, citizen from Washington County. I would not have come here to testify about this bill, but I happen to live on one of these streets. and I have for 30 years. And in our neighborhood, the basic rule has always worked really well. There's never been an accident. Where we have had problems and we've had to deal with our neighbors is those who have built fences right on the edge of the roadway rather than on their property line, or they've let their shrubs get so big you can't see around them or you can't step out of the way, which it's difficult to deal with those issues personally with people. And, you know, making a law that says you have to drive slower is another simpler way to do it, but it doesn't really solve the problem. It's still difficult. If you are walking on a street, there's no curb, there's no paved sidewalk or, you know, way to get off, and if there's a big holly bush in the way and there's a truck and a car trying to pass each other, it's really difficult. But the speed limit really doesn't solve that issue. It doesn't address visibility, and it doesn't address the ability to get off the roadway. And so I think my experience after 30 years is that the issue is not the speed that's allowed. It's teenagers who are going too fast, which they'll do no matter what the speed limit is. And it's that we have to deal with the person-to-person stuff, talking to the neighbors who have an unsafe situation in front of their house. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Wait a minute. Mm-hmm. Representative Butler.
Representative Butler, do you have a question for me?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jody, you indicate that there's fences built right up to the road. Are they encroaching upon the roadway? Is that what you're referring to?
There's a fence. The dedicated roadway in my neighborhood is 50 feet wide. The blacktop, it varies from place to place, from about 14 to probably 25 feet wide. And a neighbor recently moved into the neighborhood and put up great big cemented-in posts that are 18 inches off the blacktop and probably 15 feet from his property line. And that's a relationship issue that we're dealing with in the neighborhood right now. And we've dealt with it with bushes that obscure vision around corners, where the bushes are in the public right-of-way, not in the person's personal property. But, of course, you think you should get to choose what's in front of your house often.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just follow up.
Yes.
So your testimony, Jody, is that you have a 50-foot-wide street in front of your house.
We have a 50-foot dedicated roadway, but we only have a 14 to 22-foot street.
Okay, your testimony is that you have a 50-foot dedicated roadway in front of your house, but there are folks that have built fences or are allowing their shrubs to encroach upon that 50-foot roadway.
Right.
Thank you.
And I think that would address the problem better than the speed limit would. Thank you.
Wait a minute.
Right, I have a question.
Future. Boy.
You know, since you bring it up. Thank you, Madam Chair. In Ashland, we have several similar small blocks, and some folks have actually worked with the city to put speed bumps. Mm-hmm. And would speed bumps be a solution?
In my neighborhood, there's no need. I mean, it would slow the teenagers down for the first 3 months that they were driving, but the rest of us don't need to be slowed down. And they have to learn a little bit from experience. It's part of life, you know. We talk to them and say, you're driving too fast, and then they slow down.
Another recommendation, small boys with slingshots might work. Thank you.
Thank you. Any more questions? Okay. Thank you. Alex Campbell.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Alex Campbell. I am on the staff of the city of Milwaukee, and I'll just quickly summarize my testimony. City of Milwaukee has about 50 roadway segments that fall within the regulations or the change that's proposed. I consulted with our police, engineering, and public works staff. The directors of those departments all felt that is a worthwhile change to make. City currently would have to go through an extensive process to post 15-mile-an-hour, establish 15-mile-an-hour limits in these problematic areas. The chief also felt that while the basic rule would allow a police officer currently to cite somebody who's driving at an unsafe speed, it'd be very difficult for that citation to stick without a clear standard in the statute, which the bill provides. And I'll just I'll add the only concern that I heard from members of the staff was about the expense and the work of reposting the speed limit signs. And so there's just one suggestion to make sure that this change is made in conjunction with a change to the driver's manual, that we have additional posting requirements if there's any difference between what's posted and what's established in the driver's manual. So the coordination of those two things would be helpful to a local jurisdiction. Thanks.
Okay. Representative Tomei.
Thank you. Thank you so much for doing all this in such short notice and coming down here today, Alex. Alex, I haven't passed out to people, but I will now, and I'm assuming that a gentleman or people from Portland will be coming to talk about this. My intent to change this, if the paved portion is less than 18 feet in width, and you'll be talking about that, that's great, and some other changes. But where is it posted now? I don't think there's any posting in my neighborhood that it's 25 miles an hour, is there?
Typically, it would not be.
Right.
But if it were to be established as 15 miles an hour in statute, and that is different than if that change was made prior to the change in, say, the driver's manual being changed, then the rule on the ground would be different than what people had learned through the driver's manual, right. And we would be required to post each and every segment that was different than what people learned in their driver's manual.
Follow-up?
That's my understanding.
Follow-up?
So if this were changed so that the driver's manual was changed, whenever, how often that is changed, then it wouldn't be necessary for you to do that posting, which could be horribly expensive, right?
I don't believe so. I don't believe so. We would only have to go out and change where we've sort of voluntarily posted, and those voluntary postings are now incorrect. And in that case, we could just remove those.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Alex, thank you very much for coming forward. I appreciate this. I understand from Representative Tomei that this is on very narrow streets. It's not on 50-feet roadways, but on very narrow streets that this is applicable. Do you have a policy in the city of Milwaukee to allow people to bring their fences out into their street right away?
No, we don't. We enforce a line of sight rule that would prevent fences from encroaching on the right of way.
Follow up, if I may.
Yes.
Same with shrubs, Alec.
Yes.
Okay. So if you had someone that were actually building an encroachment out into the roadway, you would have them remove that.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Greg Chamoff.
This guy's trouble. I can see it already.
You think?
Madam Chair, members, neighbor Tomei, thank you very much for your attention this afternoon. Greg Chamoff from the city of Milwaukee. I have appeared in front of you for, I guess, going on around 16 years now in various capacities, including when I had the honor of serving as your counsel. In all that time, I've never had the opportunity to appear as a plain old everyday citizen, and so this is a first for me. House Bill 2297 is plain and simple about making our neighborhoods more safe. Those of us who live in neighborhoods that were planned out before the days of a Model A enjoy streets that are roughly 12 to 18 feet wide. In our neighborhood, the standard paved width is roughly 15 to 16 feet. At no time is it safe to drive on these streets at 25 miles an hour. It is particularly unsafe to drive them when I'm out walking with my dog. And this bill would go a long ways toward making our neighborhood and others like it more safe. In discussing matters with Mr. Lindauer and his colleagues from the city of Portland, I think we've worked out, and they can substantiate this, some suggested changes that will allow you to provide our kinds of neighborhoods the safety that we would like without at the same time interfering with the big city's fancy streets. The goal that we are looking for is to have 15 miles an hour on a roadway in a residential area, a roadway that is two-way, it wouldn't be a one-way street, where the paved portion is under 18 feet, and there that 18 feet or under 18 feet is consistent from cross street to cross street, so that if you have from one cross street to the next a portion that is under 18 and then it gets wider and goes to 20 or 30, that would remain 25 feet. It would not move down to 15. It would be a consistently narrow street. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Butler.
Thank you very much. And it is a pleasure to have Mr. Shamoff here come before us. Greg, one thing I am concerned about, and that is, of course, out where we live in the true West, in Eastern Oregon, we have a saying that good fences make good neighbors. And here I'm going to guess that good passing behavior and good driving behavior probably makes for good neighbors on one of these kinds of streets. How, when I come to visit you and Representative Tomei and I bring along my motorhome or my camp trailer, how am I going to get it up there? What do I have to pull out somewhere out of this 18-foot roadway?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, if you bring your motorhome, you will not be visiting close to our houses. We do have a nice Grange Hall nearby with a large parking lot, and we'd be glad to see you.
He doesn't want to see me. So my, in all actuality, my question is, where do people pass each other on these? Because there isn't enough room on an 18-foot. How do they? Again, they must be just good neighbors, because you're going to have extra wide driveways in some places to pull out to let folks get by.
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, one scrunches over to the side while the other person inches along, doing his or her best not to knock off your mirrors.
You can't do that at 25 miles an hour, I wouldn't guess.
Although, excuse me, Madam Chair, Representative Butler, there are unfortunately some who try.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good seeing you, Greg.
Nice to see you, sir. Thank you.
I don't know if I so much have a question but a comment. I can visualize the roads that you're talking about, and I can see the definite need. It's unfortunate that we have to have legislation for common sense, but I think in this case, boy, this is a need there, because those roads are narrow, and I can see where 25 is very, very fast in those situations.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, if everyone followed common sense, all of your jobs would be irrelevant.
Is that a motion?
Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you very much.
Well, it's great seeing you and having you back. Mark Landauer and Greg Reisman.
Thank you, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. Mark Landauer with the Office of Government Relations with the City of Portland. Thank you for allowing us to appear before you today. At the outset, I want to thank Representative Tomei for sitting down and talking with us. The City of Portland has hundreds of miles of residential streets within its city limits. And one of the difficulties we were having with the bill as originally drafted is that many of those streets within the city are approximately 28 feet wide. Many of those streets also allow for parking on both sides of the street. As a result, the impact of this bill would have made many of those streets 15 miles an hour or 25 miles an hour depending on the parking demands that were being utilized during that time period. We asked Representative Tomei if we could talk to her about how to narrow the definition of a narrow roadway in a manner that would meet her intent while still trying to maintain some consistency for the City of Portland's residential streets. I've asked Mr. Raceman here to my right to join me today to provide a little bit more technical knowledge on this subject. I'd like to turn it over to him at this time.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee for having let me testify today about this important bill. In the City of Portland, if we do not see the changes that we've talked about in terms of allowing for a roadway that's less than 18 feet, then we would have hundreds of miles of street that would have problems related to signage, and we'd also have problems related to enforcement, having a clear standard for drivers to have good understanding of when it's expected of them to travel at 15 miles an hour or 25 miles an hour. So by doing this change, it does provide for an important change where we do have improved roadways that are too narrow for safe operation at 25 miles an hour, and we do see with the change a good safety enhancement for those types of roadways in our city.
Questions? Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm somewhat confused about your addition of a contiguous portion of the roadway beginning and ending at a crossroad or roadway terminus defined as a dead end.
I'd be glad to address that. So we have roadways in our city where a portion of them are narrower than 18 feet within one block face, and a portion of them are greater than 18 feet within that block face. And so in order to reduce confusion about where the law would apply, we've asked that the law apply only on roadways where the road is consistently less than 18 feet wide for at least one block.
And that's what that's follow up.
Yes,
and that's what that says.
Yes, ma'am.
Am I the only one that doesn't get that?
I got that.
Any more questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I may, I'm anxious about the less than 18 feet in width, and I thought that Portland had a policy insofar as possible to try and make those one way. Is there an alternative to some of those that have that interface within the same block to make them one way, or is that just create compound problems, Mr. Raceman?
Well, I'd certainly like to take a stab at that, Chair Beyer, Representative Butler. Many of the streets in the West Hills of the City of Portland are in fact narrower than 18 feet. Many of those streets, in fact, have no parking space allowed. So this would apply in many instances on those streets, and I hope that gets to your question.
If I may just follow up, I am concerned about, and I've driven on some of those narrow streets, and in some cases the old rule was 18 feet. Now this specific amendment says less than 18 feet. That would making a street at 15 miles an hour, which is only less than 18 feet, that would lop off a big chunk of the highway or the road miles that you're talking about in Portland.
I'm clear on your question now. I apologize. Many of those streets that I mentioned in the West Hills, for example, are in fact less than 18 feet, and we do allow for two-way traffic on those streets. So this, in fact, does apply in many of those instances, particularly in those streets that are located in the West Hills. And there are a few places, for example, I think in Ladd's Addition, that this very well would apply where two-way traffic is permitted and some of the outer southeast portions of the city as well.
Madam Chair, I guess I just expressed concern to the committee and these folks from Portland and Milwaukee as well, that if you have a street that is 18 feet exactly, that you have two lanes of traffic on, and that is left at 25 miles an hour, that becomes as dangerous as a situation as a single lane of 17 feet 11 inches at 15 miles an hour, I would think. And I am concerned, but I don't know the result of it. But certainly, by placing it at 18 feet, again, one of the old rules was 18 feet was a street, unless you're on the Oregon coast, and that was 16 feet. But my concern is that by having it less than 18 feet versus 18 feet or less, that you're, and I know what where they're coming from. They're just saying that gives us that many more 25 mile an hour streets. But 18 feet, a street that is 18 feet that you have two-way traffic on, or parking,
right,
on the same street, and are trying to get traffic around there at 25 miles an hour, I don't know that really captures the safety issue that Representative Tomei is trying to capture in this legislation. Mark?
I'd be happy to try to address it again. I did notice that this bill isn't up for a work session. I know that there aren't any amendments drafted at this time. I'd be happy to not only consult with our traffic engineers and your committee administrator, the sponsor of the bill, whatnot. It may very well be the right change to make it 18 feet or smaller rather than less than 18 feet, just to be very clear. But again, if with the committee's indulgence, I would like to just consult with our engineers one more time if that would be agreeable.
Madam Chair, I think that would be appropriate, and they've certainly brought some amendments forward, and I would look to Representative Tomei. She's to be complimented on having a neighborhood watch committee to help on these kinds of things, to participate, to bring forward an issue. But I, as long as we're talking about public streets of 18 feet and less, then you get into the concern of what of the parking, what of the two-way traffic, and they've tried to address some of this where it's the terminus is a dead end, because you're going to have two-way traffic there. But I'm also concerned about a 18-foot street that's a dead end. You're going to have all different kinds of traffic issues that are involved there, too. And folks, they just really need to slow down. But as Representative Smith said, it's tough to legislate to common sense in this process. So. But the other issue is that we need to also make clear that the effective date of this legislation wouldn't be until the next rewrite of the driver's handbook in the state of Oregon. Else we have a fiscal issue here, and the fiscal issue moves it down to Ways and Means, where it'll probably not see the light of day.
Right.
I'm fearful. So that would be an additional amendment, Madam Chair, that should be probably addressed.
Representative Butler.
Again, we're confused
exactly.
Again.
It's
always.
Yes.
Yet again. I'm sorry if I'm just not grasping this, but this is intended for two-way traffic, not for one-way traffic. And does that need to be specified in the definition, or is it sufficient to say through traffic, this through traffic by its definition, state two-way traffic?
My read of it, Representative Buckley, is in Section 3, where it says not of sufficient width to allow one lane of traffic in each direction. And I believe that would clarify the one-way versus two.
I guess my concern would be, just as a very literal person, that a one-way street would still fit that definition. You could have a one-way street that wouldn't be wide enough for two lanes of traffic. It's not intended for two lanes of traffic, but it could still fall under that definition, and there might be confusion with it.
Could I
respond to that, please?
Yes.
Thank you. I think the amendment that we're looking at would say that is intended for two-way vehicular traffic. You don't have that in front of you, but that's an amendment that we will be proposing. That would make it clear. It should be a simple bill. It should not be complicated.
I have several amendments I'd like to offer.
Will we be hearing from ODOT?
We can ask ODOT to come up.
No,
they don't. I don't know whether they have any comments, but we might want to check after the committee
and
check in with them to get some feedback.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming.
Scott Bricker. No.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Scott Bricker, and I'm the policy director for the Bicycle Transportation Alliance and work with the Willamette Pedestrian Coalition as well. So bicyclers and walkers. Our organization support this bill, and I hadn't seen any amendments or haven't done a ton of work on this, but I have some responses to at least first thoughts about amendments, but I want to just give a real brief presentation. That for bicyclers and walkers, neighborhood traffic safety is a primary concern. There have been surveys. In fact, the city of Portland and Multnomah County do an annual survey of residents, and traffic safety comes out to be three of the top four concerns that they deal with. Their children be able to play in front of their street, being able to walk your dog, be able to just have neighborly conversations. These are really important things for people in their daily lives. As the BTA and Blind Pedestrian Coalition try and get more kids bicycling, walking to school, or just people out there on the streets, this bill really moves in that direction. So I applaud you, Representative Tomei, of putting this forward. I think it's a great concept. We also like that it would be a basic rule issue, perhaps something that's just, again, more of a common sense kind of approach than a measurement approach, in the sense of having to take out the tape measure for every single street, but say this is a common sense issue. If you have to, if two cars can't pass or two vehicles can't pass on a roadway, then you should slow down to an appropriate speed, which would be 15 miles an hour. There are statistics that show that speed is a primary cause of fatalities. And in Oregon, traffic-related automobile collisions are the top reasons for childhood fatality and injury. So this is an important issue from that level. The BTA has been working also to get bicyclists to ride on low traffic streets. We've heard from bicyclists specifically that they are concerned with automobile traffic. They're concerned with high speeds and high volumes, and we're working with the city of Portland and communities around the state to increase what are called bicycle boulevards, low traffic bicycle streets that would actually have through access, and this could also handle concerns of having bicyclists on the busier streets. So we think this is a really great first step into making a common sense approach of getting more people on the streets, and we hope that something is broad and more the general rule approach could pass through this committee and the legislature, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Any questions?
Madam Chair, I appreciate Scott coming forward. He's talking about a common sense approach, and certainly it would be great if there was a common sense approach here. The difficulty we've got is that common sense is becoming less and less common. So it's time for us to, unfortunately, have to tell people this is how we're going to be able to regulate your access to these very narrow streets.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
You're going to get mad at me, Madam Chair. Scott, while I got your ear, will you come grab me after this meeting? I want to talk to you about another issue.
Yes, of course.
Was that your question?
That was it.
Thank you.
That was an easy question. Yeah. Right, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, John O'Shell.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm John O'Shell, the County Road Program Manager with the Association of Oregon Counties. I hadn't planned to speak today because basically I'm sort of in a monitoring mode that makes sure one of two things didn't happen. One hasn't happened, so I can let it lie. And the other one, there was an implication that we would have to go out and sign all these. Now, that is an issue. I would suggest to you that what we're talking about is a 15-mile-per-hour basic speed rule. Now, as with in most other places, we post many of our basic speed rules as we feel is necessary. But in a residential area, 25 miles per hour is the speed whether it's posted or not. And our perception is that is the way we basically would treat these narrow roadways is they're 15 miles per hour whether we have a sign up there or not. If we have a problem area and complaints, we'll probably put up a sign, but we don't want to be falling in the mode that says we got to go out and put a sign on all of these. While I'm sitting here listening to the discussions about the over or under 18 foot. I would tell you that primarily we're probably going to follow the lead of the cities on this one. We do have a number of narrow roads on our unincorporated cities that are out there. Places like Oceanside have many roads just like this. I think maybe a key to the understanding is that you have a, in many cases, two-way roads that are one lane wide. This is quite common. You try and get them one way where you can, but in many cases, especially if you're on a hillside, you have a bunch of them where the driveways are built for the people going north and the other driveways are built for the people going south. And unless you're going to tell half the people they can't use their driveways, you can't really make it a one-way. So you've got to come up with a way to make it safe for them there. The way to do that is get the speeds down so they can have a chance to yield to each other. Someone jump into a driveway while someone else comes by, it's got to be done at a very low rate of speed. And so basically we support the concept.
Madam Chair, this is the problem in the counties. This I'm thinking now, John, of problems that you've got in they're public roads over in Lincoln County and along the ocean there, and those roads are typically 16 and a half feet is what they are that have actually the build out on them. The county required twice that much, which is there, but it's dedicated, but it is not being used. So what do you do for a dedicated road versus a completed road? And typically, again, when it's in the county, it's not a paved road. So I'm anxious about the definition, Madam Chair, of the dedicated road versus the completed road, too. And in Representative Tomei's case, what could happen is that you could have a road that was actually a little bit wider, but it just wasn't, because the testimony was that they don't have the curbs and gutters and sidewalks and so forth. So what happens is it just goes out into folks' lawn. And typically you could probably use their lawn, except on a rainy day, and then you don't want to be sinking your vehicle to the axles on that particular day. So I think we need a little bit more definition of those roads that have true rights of way. Because, again, I'm going to guess that many of the roads that are developed on the coast in the counties are probably rights of way at more than 18 feet. But that they're only completed to half of that, half of the total dedicated right of way.
Chairman Beyer, Representative Butler, you're absolutely correct that we have many of these roads. I mean, as I referenced, Oceanside is not a city; it's a subdivision. There is no city in Oceanside. Pacific City. Many of those cities on the coast aren't cities; they're just subdivisions, and they have very. We'd be happy to see 16 foot on a lot of those roads. They're quite skinny. And they're there, and they're not ever going to get widened, and people are going to have their landscaping and their cars parked on the side of the road. And as I said, the appropriateness of getting this down to 15 miles per hour, we're totally in support of.
But I'm still anxious about the fact that those streets, while they may be only developed, and again, they're not paved, they're just right. Developed. You got gravel on 15 or 16 feet of them. That they get rights of way that maybe 35 feet. And what are we going to do there? Are you going to limit those to 15 miles an hour? And they're traffic both ways. You're going to limit those to 15 miles an hour because they're not developed? Or are we going to say that perhaps that they can continue to go 20 to 25 miles? That you wouldn't want to go much faster than 20 or 25 miles, but that if you did go 20 to 25 miles, that you're in violation of the law, even though there is a greater right-of-way there. It's just not being used up on a neighbor's lawn. It's a question.
Any other questions? Thank you. Is there anybody else out there that I've missed? Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2297.
Is it appropriate before we close it for me to say that I will be seeking input on amendments?
Yes.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. We'll let you take this one and see what you can do with it.
We're committee of one.
Yeah. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2297. And I'm going to open an informational. I'm going to go ahead and reopen the work session on House Bill 2275. And Representative Smith requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended to allow him to be recorded as voting yes on the motion to pass House Bill 22.
Yes.
75 to the floor.
And I'm an aye. And colleagues, I apologize. My two committees overlap, and I try and run back to the office and take care of stuff and then get here, and I apologize. Thank you for letting me cast my vote.
Thank you. Any objections? Nope. Seeing it. So ordered. And I close the work session on House Bill 2275. And I'm going to open the informational meeting on and a briefing on tollways and tolling. And our guest for the day is Jim Witte. And crew.
Thank you.
Yes, Madam Chair, I brought with me Deputy for Highways, Doug Tindall.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Doug Tindall, Deputy Director for the Highway for the Department of Transportation. I'm going to turn the presentation over to Jim. I just want to set the context for you. Over the past a little bit more than a decade, following legislative direction, we have at ODOT has been looking at various options for tolling and some other innovative financing things. And it's a complicated exercise with a great deal of history and background behind it that Jim is going to describe. This is an endlessly interesting topic, or at least it's endlessly interesting to me. And I'll turn this over to Jim for the presentation. Jim.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Witte with the Oregon Department of Transportation. I'm here to give the informational briefing today on tolling highways and bridges. I'm going to discuss the historical use in Oregon, as well as the existing statutory basis for tolling. I will also be looking at modern tolling systems, which are much different than the traditional coin-in-the-basket method. I'll also give you some examples of how modern tolling is used nationally and worldwide, and then how ODOT is viewing tolling today and the projects we're currently investigating. Oregon has a long history, actually, of tolling roads and bridges. Many of the first roads and bridges in the early history of the state were privately owned and operated toll roads. That's really how the road system was constructed in the early, early years. Others were owned and operated by counties. The early toll road system in Oregon faded, however, after the Federal Highway Act of 1916 barred the use of tolls on roads that received federal funds. Many of the old toll roads were bought out by the states or local agencies. Okay, during the first 20 years of the 20th century, the state public road system was developed, and primarily on the basis of the nation's first gasoline tax. Then right around 1925, the legislature authorized the state to purchase private toll roads, and they did that to become part of the state system. Now, various governmental entities built and operated toll bridges as part of the Oregon's public road system. The original Columbia River Bridge was built in 1917 and was operated as a toll bridge until 1929, when it was taken over by the Departments of Transportation of Oregon and Washington and operated as a free bridge from that point forward. Tolls were then charged for 6 years for the construction of the second interstate bridge over the Columbia and then taken off November 1966. The other examples recently are the Astoria Bridge, operated as a toll bridge in 1966, and the tolls were taken off in 1993. And then we currently have two toll bridges that touch Oregon soil, Cascade Locks and the Hood River Bridge, operated by private entities. The tolling statutes in Oregon are really a conglomeration of policies adopted over many years. We have Chapter 381 governing interstate bridges, and then 382 governs intrastate bridges. They were both passed in 1925. We saw our first toll road legislation in 1995, when some citizens from Yamhill County decided they wanted to build a bypass around Newburgh and Dundee, and came to the legislature and actually got a toll road statute passed. There were only two facilities that were proposed as potential toll roads at that time under that law, and that was the Newburgh-Dundee Bypass and the Tualatin and Sherwood Connector. But then the next session, 1997, the law was amended to allow for an unspecified project in the Portland area. And then this law was again amended in 2001 to open up tolling possibilities statewide. Let's see. Although we have had toll bridges in our past under the toll law, the new toll road statute has yet to be used to build a toll road in Oregon. As a result, the Oregon legislature in 2003 passed the Oregon Innovative Partnerships Program to allow the use of private firms to come in and investigate, among other things, toll roads. The legislature also passed a requirement in 1999 requiring for any new road capacity that ODOT examine the feasibility of tolling as part of that new road capacity. And that's one of the authorities we're looking at now in investigating the projects I'm about to discuss. But first we'll go into the modern tolling systems so you can get an idea of what's happening, and it's much different than it was in the past. The days of sitting in long lines, waiting to throw coins in a basket, are fading quickly away. Today, systems for tolling are electronic. And more new toll roads are entirely electronic, and a lot of the older ones have an electronic option. You may have used the Easy Pass on the East Coast, or the Fast Pass in California, for example. Most of these new systems involve nonstop reading of electronic toll tags or transponders. And motorists drive past an electronic reader at a first overhead gantry, and people always ask me what a gantry is. It's the overhead item up there that you pass under where you hang cameras or readers on. And they travel at highway speeds. The second overhead gantry is equipped with cameras to read license plates to record violators. And I'll show you pictures of that. There's a central administrative office that obtains this information and then charges the proper accounts. The accounts are directly connected with whatever toll pass system is used. The toll pass is either loaded with cash, much like a prepaid phone card, or it can be deducted from a bank account or charged on a credit card. That's the choice of the user. The central administrative office, or something called a customer service center, is where the business of the roadway is conducted. Accounts are established there, and toll violations are managed there, and all public relations is managed there as well, customer inquiries and complaints. Modern transponders are no longer a big box. They are they tend to be now basically the size of a credit card with a computer chip embedded in them, and can be obtained through a kiosk or the internet or the mail or walk in or call up on the phone and order them, or through local retail businesses. They can be obtained in many, many ways, and there are ways to establish anonymity. So you do not have, nobody has to know that that you're using the toll tag, so you can drive through without nobody knowing who it is. Many toll roads contain a mixture of electronic and cash collections. The Tacoma Narrows Bridge, which is about to open soon, will combine nonstop toll collection like this on the left of that slide with a more traditional cash alternative for visitors and other travelers that want to be convenienced with cash. And so there's both options that you'll see up there on the Tacoma Narrows Bridge. And I'm not sure, Doug, we know when that was going to be open?
There was some discussion about lengthening that contract, I believe, and I don't know where WSDOT has landed on that.
It's this year, isn't it?
That's what they're shooting for.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, is that really what that's going to look like? Because back east, there's no division of the highway. You just line yourself up. and the fast tolls are on the left hand side, and the other folks, the cash, and those of us who, you know, don't travel back there very often, those are on the far right hand side, and you'll just divide yourself up rather than having a double highway. Was this provided by the state of Washington for the Tacoma Narrows?
This is conceptual.
Oh, okay.
So you can see that there's a separation. You do make your own choice, though. That's true. Yeah. Okay, the way these tend to work, and of course can be done any which way for any different road, is that toll payers are encouraged to use the transponders because it's a less expensive collection mechanism. It's about a tenth the cost to collect with electronic system as opposed to a cash system. And so a lot of these systems have an advantage to the electronic toll collection price-wise as opposed to the cash collection. Tolls can be charged in various ways. You can have a distance toll, so a per mile or per distance toll, or a point toll where you pass a point and you pay whatever toll that point is, or some combination that can vary by time of day or traffic. So all of those are used across North America right now. If the vehicle does not contain a transponder, as I mentioned, cameras contained in the overhead gantry photograph the license plate. Once the vehicle owner is identified, the Central Administrative Office sends the owner a billing. The non-paying user of the toll road is treated as a violator, but some tollways allow post-payment for a period of time. It's all a matter of how the system is designed. There are numerous options for toll enforcement. For electronic collection to become a reality in Oregon, new legislation must be enacted to provide a consequence for non-payment of tolls or other toll evasions. This may involve issuance of a civil violation with an accordion suspension of vehicle registration. I'm going to go through a few examples quickly here. The 407 electronic toll road in Colorado. I actually visited this one, and it's a free flowing road, and you can get on it without stopping, just like you get on an interstate right now in Oregon. They just have those overhead gantries on them. It's a distance charge in that you're recorded basically as entering at a certain point. When you get off at a different point, it subtracts the difference, and that's the toll taken right out of your toll tag. If you enter the facility and don't have a toll tag, you can still use it, and that's not illegal. It's just that you're going to be charging, be paying about twice the cost, roughly, to use the facility, and because now you have to enter the collection system, and they do that by this video enforcement mechanism. But anybody can use it.
Question, if I may, Madam Chair, how responsive is that to electronic? For those of us who rent cars in those areas, is it immediately available to us as we return our car to the check-in place, or will we be receiving that double billing plus the a surcharge from our credit card company from the rental card company? In other words, how quickly can we know that information?
I think this is very quickly. It's all done by computers and phone lines, so it's very, very fast.
And the Chair Beyer, Representative Butler, the rental car companies will normally equip the car with a transponder, and so the billing hits back by the time you get back to turn the car.
Thank you, Doug.
There's an interesting story about this one that you should know. I was riding along this with the people that are operating the facility. It's a beautiful facility. And I noticed off to the left there was a free-flowing road next to it. There wasn't a toll facility. And I said, Why aren't people using this road when they can get on that one? And the guy said, that one has traffic lights. And then I understood. Time savings. In Houston, we have a fixed toll at entry point. But it is relative to distance. But you'll know what the cost is getting on the facility. And violators are issued citations. in 91. You might have, some of you might have ridden this one, State Route 91 in California. This one's combined with high occupancy vehicles and toll payers. All vehicles must have transponders. It's also varied by time of day, and the prices on this one are, these are getting quite high. For the peak period during rush hour, it's at 9 1/4 now. Very, very high. In Israel, we've got a toll distance toll based on number of sections used. As you see, that if you use a transponder, you get a bigger discount than if you use cash, as well as, let's see. In Melbourne, you can have a day pass system, pick up a day pass to use on the system rather than a regular transponder that you carry with you every day. In Santiago, Chile, another day pass. And then they have, you can purchase a late day pass there. So if you just sort of forgot and got on and you want it, you want to fix it later, you can. That's it.
I have a quick question. So who paid for all your trips to these places to take pictures?
Actually, on that one, I was asked to speak on another topic at a conference, and so I just took the opportunity to go learn what I could while I was there about that particular toll road because I knew it was a modern one. ODOT's current activities. The reason ODOT is examining tolling for new capacity is that we simply lack sufficient traditional road dollars to construct and maintain large new highway projects. For these large new highway projects to be constructed, there needs to be a significant influx of new dollars. And tolls may, in some cases, provide the necessary revenue. We're currently examining three highway projects for the possibility of adding capacity through the use of tolls. The Newburgh-Dundee Bypass, widening South I-205, and then the Columbia River Crossing. The Columbia River Crossing project is jointly pursued with the state of Washington. The Newburgh-Dundee Bypass and the I-205, however, we're investigating with a private partner under the Oregon Integrated Partnerships Program, and that partner is called the Oregon Transportation Improvement Group, led by the Macquarie Infrastructure Group. We've learned through the work with this private partner that another project, the Sunrise Corridor, is not viable as a standalone tollway under a public-private arrangement. So we've learned that through our research that project cannot be worked in this manner. We've also learned that the Newburgh-Dundee bypass is feasible as a tollway under a public-private arrangement, but there appears to be a significant funding gap given the information the private partner has given us, even under aggressive toll scenarios. We're currently verifying that data with our own expert. The project to widen I-205 also appears viable. But we need further development work on that one to work with the local communities to define exactly what the project is, how many lanes, and how long it goes, and then commence the environmental process. Both the bypass and I-205 are nearly ready to proceed into the next milestone under the agreements with the private firm, but have a few more steps to take before we would actually take that step. And it won't be ODOT that takes it. It'll be the commission that recommends we go forward or not.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
In that regard, James, as we're considering the possibility of a freeway toll on a freeway that circumvents another freeway, actually you could go around the toll area and stay on a freeway if you wanted to. Would that be the smart way to do that, or wouldn't it be better to make sure that both accesses that are freeway accesses have the toll? I guess I'm concerned about when you toll one freeway that's a loop freeway to another freeway access, it seems like you'd push more traffic back onto the I-5 in this case.
Chair Beyer, Representative Butler, the What you're talking about is what's called diversion, and it's the amount of diversion you get is dependent on the toll, the level of the toll that you charge, and then how much time savings there is. So it's not the Oregon Trucking Association sitting behind me will tell you that they prefer to have that free alternative there, not necessarily so that they have a free alternative, but so that they are sure that if they're paying, they can get through quickly. So it's not uncommon to have a situation where the free alternative does jam up to some extent, and the traffic. It's amazing how people will consider the value of their time and judging whether or not they want to take the toll road. And if you put the tolls at the right level, the diversion can be not all that high. In other words, people will just see the advantage to doing it.
Madam Chair, if I may, I'd want to make sure that when we talk about South I-205, we're talking about lanes in South I-205 that go both north and south.
No, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, there's one thing to always remember in this. Time savings really matters. People are willing to buy for time saving. We do not know yet whether...
We have another question over here. Representative Smith.
I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is it the department's intention as they enter into, as they consider these projects, that as the debt service on these projects is paid off, that the toll would go away?
Chair Beyer, Representative Smith, under the it depends on how you go about doing the tolling. It's a very good question. The in a public-private partnership, you would have the private entity putting up a significant amount of money up front. And so the reason that they would do that is to get a return on their investment over a long period of time. So you would actually pay off not only the cost of the initial construction and the maintenance and operation for the time that the private company is operating it, but also a rate of return for the private company. So it's not exactly, it doesn't exactly stop when they've hit the construction cost.
Let me pursue that though a little further. So their rate of return could go far, far beyond the debt service, and then that becomes an increased net profit for them at the expense of Oregonians.
Chair Beyer, Representative Smith, that's the one of the tricky parts about public-private partnership is you have to make sure that you negotiate that correctly so that you there are ways to negotiate that contract so that you are assured that you know what their profit margin or their profit will be up front, and so that you are protected against a windfall profit, if you will, by growth in traffic and uncontrolled toll increases. Yes. So it is a very complex issue to deal with.
Without knowing the particulars at all, to me it would seem to our advantage as a state to take a percentage of profits into perpetuity. With that said, though, with the state's bonding capability, wouldn't it make more sense if we have the ability to bond it ourselves, to do it ourselves rather than entering into a private partnership, so that way when the debt service is paid off, we could take those additional revenues and perhaps move it to another Dundee-type project or another I-5-type project?
Chair Beyer, Representative Smith, in fact, that's exactly the analysis that's going on in the Newburgh-Dundee project right now with our own, with a separate firm to come in and do a financial analysis. They will give us what's called a public comparator, where they will tell us the answer to that question. How much would you have to bond publicly, and what would be the length of time that tolls would have to be charged to recover that cost versus having a private sector bring you the money up front, and what we know what tolls they would charge. So yes, we will look at that and bring that as a policy discussion to the commission.
That's a tricky one.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Doug. As we're considering those public-private partnerships, my hope is that if you end up with three public-private partnerships that start off South I-205, the Newburgh-Dundee, and the Columbia River Crossing, that the same toll card will be able to work in all of those, and then on any other non-public-private partnerships that you may be considering at the same time.
Chair Byer, Representative Butler, the Commission has already taken action to ensure not only will we have one standard for the state of Oregon, but our standard, in fact, matches the one in the state of Washington, and my understanding is also interoperable with the one that's used in California. So, yeah, we don't want to paste a bunch of transponders across somebody's windshield.
Representative Tomei.
I have a couple questions, Madam Chair. I'm wondering why the Sunrise Corridor, why that wasn't viable?
Yeah, it's only a the first part is only 5 miles long. And so most of the traffic is on the end that is closest to 205. And so there just isn't a lot of time savings there. There's also not a tremendous amount of traffic. I mean, it's an egregious situation right now, but you have to have a tremendous amount of traffic that are going to pay for the new system. So they looked at it, the private firm looked at it from a new toll facility that only tolled that, as well as tolling existing capacity to see if that part would work, and they discovered that even that doesn't work because there's other issues. There's a spider web of roads in and out of there, and to toll all of them is just impractical. So we were disappointed because that's a facility that the state wants, and it's an important facility, and we still support, and we're going to try to find another way to build it. But as a toll facility, it has lots of problems.
Okay. Follow-up? Thank you. Especially that seems disappointing when there's going to be more building out in Damascus and Boring in that area. That is disappointing.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, it might be one we want to look at out again 5 or 8 years and see what it looks like then. It's just that right now the picture isn't clear right. That it works.
Right. If I had to have one more follow-up.
Yes.
So, I've lost it. I've lost. Oh, well, I did lose it. Sorry.
All right.
My senior moment.
Madam Chair, while Representative Tomei is working for it there, let me just ask this, though. Is it better off to take two bites at that apple because the second bite may be much more expensive? Do you have the rights of way already, or do you, in the infrastructure that with the housing additions and so forth in Damascus and Boring that Representative Tomei was referring to, are those folks adding the infrastructure and the transportation system with the necessary rights-of-way in place?
Chair Byer, Representative Butler, right-of-way purchases are continuing on the Sunrise Corridor. There is a federal earmark for that purpose, and I'm not sure that it buys all the right-of-way, but it was a pretty substantial earmark, and Clackamas County has also contributed to that, too. So while we are trying to figure out how to finance the construction for it, we are still planning to construct the project and buying right away and protecting. It's a very good point, protecting us against the cost of inflation of the land.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Tomei.
Thank you. I remember what I was going to ask. So the Newburgh-Dundee bypass, that's interesting. You were talking about the Sunrise Corridor. There wasn't enough traffic. And so there must be enough traffic in the Newburgh-Dundee. And is it long enough? You said the Sunrise Corridor was just 5 miles. So would the Newburgh-Dundee bypass be longer than that, and there's more traffic than there would be on Sunrise?
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, Newburgh-Dundee project is 11 miles long, so it's a bit longer. But even that one, there's a challenge about whether there's sufficient revenue if you toll only the bypass alone or whether you have to toll the existing 99 with it. And so that's really the issue there as well. So it's still a challenging project.
Thank you. Representative Reed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A real easy question. On the facilities you mentioned that have the options for cash or the transponder use and so on, do they ever do differential pricing to incent the use of transponders?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
So
Chair Byer, Representative Reed, yeah, they do. It's going to cost you more to pay cash than it is to use a transponder. It's going to cost you more if you choose not to have a transponder and pass through and get the photo post-billing. Those are all going to have a surcharge associated with them to encourage the transponder use.
Yes, the issue there is what is the cost of collection? And the cost of collection is greater, the cost of the toll goes up.
Perfect. Thank you.
Any other? Representative Butler.
Thank you. I wanted to ask this question earlier, but that brings it up to pivot off of Representative Reed's question, and that is the access to the cards themselves, are they very easy to get in Washington or other states where they have these on cards, the transport cards? Are they accessible? Can I go to some place and actually buy one or add more to my credit? Or do I have to wait for it to come by mail? Or do I have to stand in a line somewhere? What's the status there?
This is done, Madam Chair, Representative Butler, this is done many, many ways. The private firms that operate these facilities, and by the way, even public facilities tend to be operated by private operators. They are professionals, and their whole aim is to get the cost of collection down. And so they make this ubiquitous. You could even buy an account or buy a card where you fill up the account by going online.
Okay.
So it's that not everybody has a computer, but they make it as easy as possible to use an electronic system. That's the
my
whole
phone
game.
Card, in effect.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's
exactly.
Right.
Add $25 when I need
exactly.
It.
That's right.
Good. Excellent.
I have a question. We do have a bill that's sitting out there that, if I remember it right, would require you to come to the legislature if you were going to embark on any tolling. I know there were a couple of different concepts, but I think that's the bill that's out there. Can you kind of let us know the issues that might happen with that? Or
well, Chair Beyer, that would be a particular challenge in the public-private partnership arena, because you would lengthen out the amount of time it would take, because you'd have to go and get legislative approval and then start the negotiation with the private sector firm. So it's just a phasing issue, and it would return you to where we were in 1995, where essentially that was the situation, with the exception of bridges, that was the situation. So the state has moved forward progressively, and as Jim gets invited to go out and talk to other groups because we are being progressive. So it would be a step back, and it would be a timing issue.
Thank you. Are you?
I can sum up if you'd
okay.
Like. We do not yet know whether tolling of roads and say new bridges within the state is going to be acceptable to Oregonians. We do know that the new electronic systems are, to the extent we get to the point of using them, will be more acceptable than the old basket method. People still have a picture in their minds. Oh, I got to stop. Why would I want to do that? But if they want the road facility and they want to be able to use it quickly, the new systems are going to allow that. We're essentially have faced three choices on funding our road systems right now for the large projects. We can significantly increase the gas tax and other such revenue sources, such as registration fees, or we can use tolls where appropriate for some of these desired large improvements, or we can do nothing and let the road system stay in a stressful condition. That's really kind of where we are today.
Madam Chair, number three is not an option. Take that off the table.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen, for your time. And I'm going to close the informational hearing. And I'm going to close the committee, unless there's anything.
No meeting Friday.
And we are adjourned.